thank you everyone for coming along, and hopefully you're all enjoying the wine that you've got in front of you. But John's a winemaker at First Draw. I found out about them another place I was helping out, and they made, like, I think the first one I had was the Matador, which is a crazily good straight Garnacha, and it just became a bit of an obsession. And he's John's just switched distributors in Melbourne, which prompted the event that we did. And John was supposed to join us, but there was lockdown, and he fled the state, and fair enough too. And so we didn't get to hear any of the stories. So I reckon we just start with talking about First Draw as an overview.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Phil. So I we'll go back before First Drop, shall we? I have got European family. Can you guys, you just cut out.
Have we got you?
Got me? Okay. European heritage. So I made home wine at home growing up with my grandfather and my father. And I grew up in the far west coast of South Australia in a fishing town, population of maybe, 2,000 or 3,000. Beer drinking, bourbon drinking, Australian country town. So we couldn't buy wine. So the old man would buy grapes and we'd make wine and, drink wine at home. Traditionally, it was Grenache. Like, it was the cheapest grape you could buy at the time, and nobody really wanted Grenache in those days because it was, not fashionable. It was Cabernet and a Shiraz. So made wine growing up with my father and grandfather, and always had wine at home. And when it was time to sort of leave uni, I dropped out of uni, moved to Adelaide, dropped out of uni, and I had to do something with my life. So I just sort of fell into the wine business because I liked drinking wine and, had a bit of an idea about making wine, and I guess the rest is history. So worked vintages, worked for other wineries around the place and overseas. And in 2004, started First Drop Wines with the vision to make not only Shiraz and Cabernet and Chardonnay, but also bring the learnings back that we'd discovered from abroad. So drinking Anise, drinking Nebbiolo, Barbera, Montepulciano, Pinot Grigio, Torriga Nacional, and Assyrtiko and Xinomavro and whatever. So bringing all those learnings and those grape varieties back to Australia and saying, hey, there's more to the grape business and the wine business. It's more than what we're exposed to. So in 2004, First Drop was born, and the first wine we released was an Alvarinho from the Barossa Valley and an Arnis from the Adelaide Hills. And I remember talking to the bank manager about, the sales pitch and whatever. He just sort of looked at me and said, I don't even know what these things are. Are they wine? Are they grapes? Are they whatever? So that didn't go down very well. But it's 16 years later. We now export to about 20-odd countries and have a winery that's based in Eureopta in the Barossa Valley. And I guess it's been a pretty cool ride. And, it's sort of how the winery started, by learning about, I guess, grapes, vineyards and winemaking abroad and at home and bringing that to the table. Of course, we make a whole series of Shiraz and Cabernet and Chardonnay as well. That's sort of, that's really important to us. But the alternatives, the Nebbiolos, the Barberas, the Anise, is what sets us apart a little bit. So that was, that's the First Drop story in a nutshell. It's been a great ride, and it's been great to see not only alternative varieties do well in Australia with other producers, but also other producers bringing in new varieties that they're quite passionate about, like Fiano and Vermentino and all of these other sort of varieties that weren't around when we started first drop, or if they were, they're, you know, minuscule.
I was going to ask about the Albarino, because that would have been about the time, or was it just after they discovered a lot of the Albarino in Australia was actually Sauvignon? So correct. Was it an authentic one, or were you making one of the...
No, our Albarino was Sauvignon. So we made the first Albarino, well, Sauvignon, in Australia in, I want to say 2002, at St. Hallett, and convinced a grower to plant what we thought was Albarino. Let's call it Albarino for now. It was aged in French oak on its yeast lees for about 6 months. It was really textural, and it was just delicious. And then convinced the, and so we made like two barrels. So then we convinced the grower to plant some more rows, and started making it at first drop in 2004, a few years later. And in about 2006, I think it was discovered that Albarino was in fact Sauvignon, and the rest is history. We don't make Albarino anymore, which is a shame. But the Sauvignon was, you know, even though it was not Albarino, it was delicious. It was a great wine, beautiful food wine, excellent with rich dishes, not only, you know, fish dishes, but also richer poultry dishes. It had some great texture and great flavour.
I thought it was funny that everyone was mad for Albarino when it was released, and they were all over it, and they wanted more and more of it. And then the minute it was 70, and everyone went, no, I don't like that. It's exactly the same wines they were drinking the year before, or a couple of years before. It was like, it was a bit of a shame. I assume people still make it, but it kind of dropped off the map. I don't know.
It's just not a thing anymore. I think it just lost its whatever. It's a shame because Sauvignon was, all the wines we made from the Sauvignon grape were delicious. But consumer behavior is sometimes swayed by what have you, especially when you're at that point of the market, that pointy end where, you know, all the people drinking those wines would have been very well knowledge, have a lot of wine knowledge. And read a lot, and obviously, you know, that was it for them. It was it was a done deal. Shame.
Hey, so I do want to actually ask you about consumer behavior. I'm just going to drop into the chat a link to all of the labels that you have, and there's no consistency in your packaging except for the screw caps. What's going on there? Is that a smart thing or what?
Having spent a lot of time in corporate Australia in the wine business for all my sins in a previous life, and you know, I learned a lot in the wine in corporate Australia about branding and packaging and systems and bookkeeping and whatever. It was great, but there was no real creativity. There was no flair. It was just like the same old. So wanted to be brave and wanted to change the way wine was being packaged and have some fun with it. And hopefully each of the labels would communicate the essence of the wine and tell its own story. So that's the reason why. And has it served us well in terms of consistency and recognition? Probably not. But at the end of the day, we're in this game to be artistic and express ourselves. And I believe we can do that in the package. And if we're not going to be, you know, a big corporate, which we're not, then who cares? So a lot of people don't even know who First Drop is. They know things like wines like Endless Summer or Mother's Milk or The Cream. They haven't tied those brands to the winery.
Yeah.
Which is sort of cool. It doesn't really worry me.
Yeah. Well, if you're selling wine, I guess that's the important thing. Actually, So, like, I really want to talk about the Nebbiolo, and I think most people tonight are drinking the Nebbiolo. But I just want to talk about the Endless Summer Pinot Grigio. It's incredibly, it's incredibly good. It's when Toby the Rep was saying we're doing a 2021 Pinot Grigio, I was expecting kind of pear juice, you know, like in slightly acidic water. And I know we tasted it, and it's got texture, and it's for such a young wine, it's just such a complete wine and enjoyable wine. So what have you done that have actually made it taste so good?
You know, it's corny, but it's these wines start off being made in a vineyard. So site selection is really important. This particular site in the southern Adelaide Hills, just out of Meadows, is being run by some great...
Oh, you muted yourself, John.
Yeah, that's my phone. So it's all about vineyard balance. Quite often, Pinot Grigio is overcropped. So this is not the case. So it's only sort of yielding about 2 or 3 tonnes to the acre, or about 6 tonnes to the hectare. Picked at its optimum sort of ripeness, which is about 12 Baume. Yeah. And then it's picked at night, rushed to the winery, pressed off. Only free run juice is pressed off. So no pressings. So no, you don't get that bitterness or any of that those phenolics. And it's a really, really cold ferment for about 2 weeks on its fine lees, with no stirring, but fine lees contact for 2 weeks, and it's bottled fresh. So there's nowhere to hide. There's no smoke or mirrors. It's all about purity of fruit, but purity of beautiful fresh fruit. So if you saw a photo of the Pinot Grigio grapes that were hand-picked, no, they were pristine. That's how we make Pinot Grigio. So
now we've got a question from Ksenia, and she asked, are all the grapes grown on the vineyard? Now, in fact, do you own any vineyards at all?
No, so all of our wines are made from vineyards that are owned by growers. There's been a great history in the Barossa and McLaren Vale and the Adelaide Hills, especially the Barossa and McLaren Vale, of growers just growing grapes for wineries. And we work with growers that are specialists in their regions for the grape varieties that they grow. Quite often with the Italian varieties, we've convinced the growers to plant those varieties for us. And contracted the fruit, and we work pretty closely with them at pruning, for spray programs, irrigation programs, canopy management, crop thinning, leaf plucking, yield management, and then harvest. So whilst we don't own the vineyards per se, we work very, very closely with all our growers who that's all they do. They are specialists, viticulturists and grape growers. So, and also our northernmost vineyard in, say, Ebenezer in the Barossa, and our southernmost vineyard in Wollonga in the Adelaide Hills are about 100 kilometres apart as the crow flies. So very difficult to manage multiple sites. We don't own any of our vineyards. We just own the winery and make the wine.
And how big would a batch be for your wines?
Sorry, I just cut out there.
How big is a batch for you? Like, you know, would it be, you know, a couple of ton or 20 ton? Like, what kind of?
Yeah, so let's say the Montepulciano site, that's a really bony site. That produces about 300 dozen Montepulciano on average a year. So that's about 5 tons, small parcel. The Nebbiolo site is about 5 or 6 tons. The Pinot Grigio is a bit more; it's about 10 tons. But they're all pretty much tiny production on everything. The biggest production we have is with Mother's Milk Shiraz, and that's sort of got a life of its own. And that's all Barossa fruit from Ebenezer and Seppelsfield. and a little bit from Eden Valley. But apart from Mother's Milk, which is about 20,000 cases, everything else is tiny.
Yeah. And we've got a question from Charlie, and he asked, is Meadows, and I might have missed what Meadows is, a warmer climate for Grigio than typical Australian Grigios?
It's pretty cold in Meadows, Charlie. It's freezing. So, yeah, typically Meadows was cow sort of dairy country. So it's always quite lush. It sort of has a bit of a rained band that always falls in Meadows. It's quite moist. And this particular site is on an elevated site, top of a hill, so it gets free drainage. But Meadows is cold. Yeah, Meadows is cold. It's not as cold as Piccadilly, where the Chardonnay comes from, but it's cold. I'm actually heading there tomorrow to check out the pruning. I'll send you a photo, but it's cold.
Mm.
Awesome. I might be back from my cousins have got a farm down there, but I only have to go there at Christmas when it's really hot.
Sorry, you just...
Don't worry. It's all good.
Yeah, so guys, there's a chat feature there. So if you've got any questions for John, you can shoot them in there if you don't want to shout out in front of the class. John, I'm dying to know about the Nebbiolo. I put it's the best Nebbiolo in Australia, and I don't really want to overstate it, but I just can't think of a better Nebbiolo I've had from Australia than your wine. So tell us about how you make it and what makes that so special.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Nebbiolo in Australia is made in a few different spectrums. There's some light, bright, fruit-driven styles, which are almost like a Pinot-esque style where it's quite bright. And there's some sort of in-between that are sort of a little bit savoury, but having worked in Piemonte and visited Piemonte a few times, Nebbiolo for us is all about savouriness and texture and fine tannin. So this particular vineyard in 2012 is from a site in Kersbrook, which is, it's not the coldest part of the hills, but it's sort of moderately cold. And whilst it doesn't have the soil profiles of Piemonte, or those calcretion soils that look like muddy cement, basically, when they're wet, it's got some nice clays, nice alluvials. This vineyard now was planted, this is about planted in 1996 when I was running Chain of Ponds. So the owner of Chain of Ponds in those days, Italian chap, went to Italy and brought back all these great varieties that I thought were a good idea to plant. So it comes from that site in Kersbrook. It's a well-managed site. It's, you know, very small production. And in terms of winery, we pick the fruit when we feel it's physiologically ripe. It's got, you know, flavour ripeness, but also acid ripeness and tannin ripeness. So the seeds have to go brown, and then we pick. And then in the winery, if you've seen winemaking in Piemonte, it's quite often the fruit spends a lot of time on skins to help extract colour. This Nebbiolo is basically anemic, doesn't have a lot of colour in the skin. But by doing that, by working the wine in the winery, you know, on its skins, you're not only extracting colour, but you're also softening tannins. So we work the wine pretty hard for about anywhere between 2 to 4 weeks in the winery, depending on the vintage. And then we age the wine in large format French oak, particularly coopered by a company called Gumba. So Gumba is an Italian cooper that's used extensively throughout Piemonte. So that sees the first year or two in Gumba oak, 500-litre pungens, and then in the last year, we put them in these large botti by another Italian cooper called Gaboletto, and the wine matures in large oak for the last 12 months of its life, typically. So you know, all we're building is softness and savouriness, not too much oak characteristic, just softening tannins and I guess enhancing those sort of sarsaparillas and those sort of mints that you get from Nebbiolo. And then it needs time in the bottle. So Nebbiolo loves to age. So this wine is current release is 2012. It's a passion wine. It's not a, you know, it should be. So
John, Hugh asked, what made you decide to wait 9 years before you released it? Like, are you trying this wine every year and going, not yet, not yet, not yet? Or is it always, we're going to release this at 9 years old, it's going to be perfect?
Yeah. It was, I just wanted to get it right. And because, you know, I think we need to sort of stand up for, like, for what we believe in. And we could have released it earlier and it could have been a little bit sort of more simple and probably more fruit forward than savouriness. Just wanted to get it right. So that's why it was released now. So, yeah, I've got some old Nebbiolos there sitting in the cellar, just collecting dust that are pretty close. But yeah, it's a long-term project and I'm glad that you guys like it because, it's been a long time coming.
I bet it's waiting 9 years to let people try it. Now, Ivan's asked, just for some context, for those of us who haven't been to Piedmont, sadly, and I spent one night there, so I still need some context. What's the climate like or equivalent to an Australian site? Probably
Piemonte?
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, Piemonte is punctuated by its undulating terroir, its hills. It's very hilly. There's one or two rivers that flow through the place that also not only does water flow through these valleys, but air goes through there. So air's always moving. So frost is managed through these, what they call fiumare, these rivers. The soils are more calcrean. So if you sort of get cement and mix it with mud, they're like a sloppy sort of clay sort of calcrean soil, which holds moisture really, really well. So a lot of the sites are not irrigated. They're just natural rainfall. Also, what you see in Piemonte that we don't have in Australia is a high amount of moisture in the air. So in the morning when you wake up and you sort of go to your car or look out your window, there's a lot of dew and a lot of moisture in the air, and that helps with the vineyards as well. And it's a long, mild ripening season. So northern Italy doesn't get as hot as southern Italy. Sure, it gets warm, but it doesn't get crisp. So there's no real big heat waves typically. And Piemonte and Nebbiolo Nebbia in Italian means fog. So therefore the name Nebbiolo. So quite often it's picked in the autumn when it's raining and foggy. And the varieties, it's not waterproof. I mean, it's susceptible to disease, but because the bunches are typically not very tight, they dry out pretty well. Also from a viticultural perspective, there's not a lot of canopy because it doesn't get hot, so there's no need for sunburn protection. So if there is rain or moisture in the air, the wind that flows through the place, because it's, you know, quite mountainous, acts as a dryer. So it's just a perfect place to grow late ripening grape varieties like Nebbiolo. And I've got one or two varieties that they plant earlier, that plant for picking earlier, like Barbera and Dolcetto and what have you. But it's, you know, they've been growing grapes there for centuries, and the site selection is perfect for Nebbiolo. And where you can't grow grapes, they grow these oak trees. And in that Cowcretian soil, it's perfect for truffles. It's a very fertile, very affluent area. So if they're not growing Barolo grapes or Barbaresco grapes, they're growing truffles. And if they're not growing truffles, they're growing hazelnuts. So it's quite a lucrative, rich area of viticulture and agri business. So you know, you could be easily run over by a Rolls Royce in Piemonte rather than a Fiat. Put it this way.
So I guess following on from that question, you've got the Nebbiolo from Kersbrook, which is what most of us are drinking now. In Australia, is there somewhere else you would ideally source your Nebbiolo from?
Yeah, I've seen some really good expressions of Nebbiolo from producers in Victoria. So the Yarra Valley has a few producers that spring to mind that are pretty good. I think Fletcher makes one out of that part of the world, and there's one or two other producers that the wines I think are super impressive. It's a cooler climate grape. Could you grow it in Margaret River? Maybe down south. Could you grow it in New Zealand? Definitely. Tasmania, definitely. It's just about finding the right site and also somebody that's prepared to do the work and understand that there's got to be 4, 5, 6 years of just trial and error. But I think the Adelaide Hills is perfect for it, and potentially the Yarra, where they're growing it now and making it now is excellent. It's just a matter of then having the patience in the winery to keep the wine.
Yeah, not many 9-year-old Nebbiolos for sale as current release, that's for sure. So Charlie asked us too about the Nebbiolo. If cellaring, how long do you think is the longest to lay it down?
Good question. So under Strewcat and in the right cellar, so I'm not talking about under your bed or under the stairs or even in a Coravin, in a Vintec freezer, with a fridge, whatever they're called. But in a cellar situation, I've seen Nebbiolo in Italy that's 50 years old and looks amazing. It's just got an uncanny ability to age, and they look fresh. Drank Nebbiolos in the vintage in the 50s, and it's just like wow, it looks like this. It looks like it's 10 years old. So they just have an amazing ability to live forever.
Yeah, at an event that I was part of, somebody brought along a then 20-year-old Nebbiolo, like Barolo, and it just looked like it had just been bottled. Yeah. And I chatted to a few people and said, why does this even happen? Like, how does this work? It's so almost cruel that you've got a 20-year-old wine that tastes so young.
Yeah, it's tannin, it's acid, adds freshness. And because it's not fruit forward, it's if you look at these big old wines that were being made in Australia, in the day, and once the fruit falls apart, there's nothing much to hold them up, but these aren't very fruity, they're more savoury, and there's the structures in the acid and the tannin, and they just live forever. Yep.
So I'm going to ask you now about the cream. So yep. We ended the last event with the cream. I know Ksenia's got the cream there in a decanter, and I'm actually drinking it tonight. It's not a wine I would normally just reach for. Like, big Rosa Shiraz is not something that often excites me. But this is something else. So I opened mine on Tuesday, and I've just sort of been trying it, like a glass each night. And the change from the first night, where it was super oaky and really tight, to now where it's almost sort of silky and there's so much going on. But just, tell us how we got that wine.
Yeah. So the cream is a barrel selection of our three prize single vineyard wines from three villages, if you like, in the Barossa that are viticulturally, but also historically important to the region, if you like. And those vineyards have been run by growers that have run them for generations. So, you know, four, five, six generations worth of viticulture in the same family. So one from Ebenezer, one from Seppelsfield, and one from Barenock. So the three single vineyard sites are managed by these I guess, custodians. They don't plan on selling them. They don't plan on, you know, being part of a corporate thing. They just grow grapes. And when this sort of ownership ends, it'll be passed on to the next generation. That's what they do. So that's really, really important. It's a sort of provenance of vineyard and place. So these single vineyards are kept separately. They're all vinified the same way. So they all see about 14 days on skins, predominantly 100% French oak. Seppelsfield sees a little bit of American oak, and 20 months in oak. And then they spend another 20 or 24 months in the cellar pre-release. So the current release is 2016 for the cream and the fat of the lands. So the cream is a barrel selection of the best barrels from those three sites. And it's blended to express, I guess, the ultimate Shiraz from the vintage. We don't make it every year. We only make it in years that are outstanding. And it's a tiny, tiny case make. It's 200 dozen per vintage if we do make it.
And what about optimum drinking for that? Because it's a wine that, like, it's not a wine you want to open now, really. It's
Yeah. I'm going to have one tonight at with some mustard and curry. But I think, look, I like looking at wines, you know, when they're 3-4 years old, when they're 5 years old, 8, 10, so on and so forth, and just watching them evolve. It's quite often when you're cellaring wine, you can miss the starting gate, if you like. And you know, it's quite often, you go to your cellar, you think, oh bugger, I should have drank that last year or the year before. So I like watching these wines evolve and drinking them regularly throughout their life. And ideally, you know, the last bottle you have, you know, should be at its peak, hopefully. Yeah. But what you did is spot on. They love air and they love to breathe. And as they breathe, they wake up again and they show you, you know, parts of themselves that you wouldn't think that Barossa Shiraz would do. And quite often, you know, these traditional Barossa Shiraz grapes or wines are just drunk, you know, at a steakhouse in the old days, and, you know, with a splash of the decanter and really just, you know, not properly consumed over 8 hours or 12 hours or even 24 hours of decanting. So, I mean, what you did is perfect. It's spot on. So you can open it, you know, the day before, take a glass out to the shoulder and just let it, put the cork back in and let it sit for 24 hours. That's ideal.
Yeah, it's pretty ideal. And Ksenia said she opened hers at 11 o'clock this morning and it's drinking very well. So that's a vote for that.
Excellent.
I think it's interesting that you're very much championing the alternative varieties, but you have this, like, this huge production of Shiraz, which is very, very traditional. And is what I like, you know, what's, I guess, what happened there? Why did you elect to make this much Shiraz as well as the alternate?
Because I got to pay the bills.
Fair enough.
Yeah. All of these other little baubles on our Christmas tree are awesome wines, but you can't sort of run a business on selling Nebbiolo at 9 years old or aging,
yeah,
you know, Shiraz for, you know, for 4 years in, you know, $5,000 barrels. So we needed something that had to resonate with consumers, but also something that we could make year in, year out, which was going to be outstanding value for money in a cool package that all sorts of walks of life would like and like to drink. So with Mother's Milk, that's that wine. So Vineyards and Ebenezer and Seppetsfield, a little bit of the Eden Valley fruit for freshness. 12 months in French oak, but no new oak. So 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, large oak barrels. Showing softness and richness, but and balance and some fresh acidity as well, which is that Eden Valley portion. You know, sometimes it sees 15% Eden Valley, sometimes it sees 5% Eden Valley in the blend. But what the Eden Valley fruit does give is structure and some firmness to wrap around that beautiful, voluptuous Barossa Shiraz.
Yeah, so at the masterclass, we had the Mother's Milk, which is lovely. We had the Makulta Cold Sweat, and then the cream. And it was funny because obviously the Mother's Milk's quite juicy and very typical Barossa Shiraz, and the cream's massive. But it was this very elegant Shiraz right sandwich in between them, and it was such a disparate kind of change between wines. It's amazing how they're not that far apart, but the wines are styles are completely different.
Yeah, sure. Look, the Barossa is a great place to grow grapes and make wine in because there's a different soil profile every sort of kilometre down the road, if you like, in the Barossa, and also the elevation difference between the Barossa floor and the Eden Valley is significant. And the Eden Valley region is quite arid, punctuated by its minerality in the soil. So that's a really old, ancient soil profile with lots of rocks and minerals through it, which dials up flavours and Shiraz and quite savoury and, accentuates tannins. Whereas the Barossa is a little bit warmer, a little bit higher rainfall, not much, but a little bit higher. And it creates Shiraz that's a bit juicier and more fruit forward and more chocolates. Whereas up in the Eden Valley, it's more savoury and more licorice, if you like. Just a basic way of describing, the fruit spectrum flavours of Eden Valley versus Barossa Valley. Also, interestingly, the Eden Valley's an 800-year-old landmass, and it's a lot of that fertile topsoil has been leached away over the years, so it's pretty arid, and that arid soil profile helps devigor the vines and create Shiraz of great concentration as well. It's a really, really cool place to make wine from. Not very good if you're a grape grower because very, very tiny yields per acre. Amazing place to make wine from. So, we're lucky to have that fruit resource in the Barossa.
And then I know that Bruce and Sue had ordered quite a bit of the Chardonnay. So let's talk about the Merritt Fills because that's a pretty special wine as well.
Yeah. So Merritt Fill is a French. The label speaks of old France. So mère in French is mother, and fille is child or son. So a lot of the French producers were, such and such and son, some father and son. So this is mother and son. So it's a bit of a piss take. But the wine is very, very serious. Predominantly fruit from Piccadilly. I worked with Lion Nathan years ago, and they owned a winery in the LA Hills called Petaluma, and a lot of those vineyards from Petaluma for the Chardonnay were from the Piccadilly area or around Piccadilly. Piccadilly is the high country for Chardonnay. Sees about 6 months in French oak with regular daily yeastling stirring. And then bottled and let to age in the cellar for about 12 months pre-release. So made a traditional style where it sees some some oak and some youth leaf stirring, but there's also some in 2018 it's a warmer, riper year, so also has some restraint as well. So similarly to Shiraz, that I reckon Chardonnay or Chardonnay should be decanted. And maybe served after about an hour of, you know, taking it out of the fridge and letting it sit in a decanter, double decant it back into the bottle. And you'll get an amazing, not just for ours, but any good Chardonnay. You'll see that wine really, really pop.
Yeah, that's something I don't ever do really is decant whites, but yeah, like you say, some of those Chardonnays are so complex and so dense. Is it the grape variety that requires the decanting, or is it the way that it's made that you think?
Yeah, good question. I'm not sure. I would say a bit of both. It likes to breathe as a grape variety, and yeah, potentially the way it's made with a bit of oak. That can definitely be enhanced by air contact. And also temperature.
Yeah.
You kick the Chardonnay in the fridge with your 4X gold. Probably a little bit too cold. It probably needs to be at the old traditional European cellar temperature of about 12 degrees or thereabouts. So that, therefore, when you're taking it out, decanting it, sits outside for an hour or so. It probably get to 10 or 12 degrees and put it back in the bottle, and then you're away. It makes a significant difference.
Yeah, it does. And so you kind of want the white about cellar temperature rather than Australian room temperature, I guess.
Sure.
I did a dinner focusing on Piedmont. We had Narnaise from Vietti. And I was telling everyone how amazing it was, and it tastes like Chablis. You know, it's got this texture and these lovely line of acid. And then the restaurant, they pulled it out of the fridge, and it was at 4X temperature, like you say, and it just tasted like nothing, absolutely nothing. And we're all standing around drinking this really disappointing wine, and I'm kind of like, what do you do? I didn't tell them to not chill it down to 0 degrees, but... Hey, that temperature of service can make a huge impact on the wine too.
100%. And look, there's a lot of restaurants, not only in Australia but around the world, that just don't get that right. It is what it is. But at least at home you can control all of these things, and you can you can hopefully enjoy wine at the right temperature, with the right air contact. And It definitely makes a huge difference.
Hey, John, it's Ivan here. Can I just ask a question in regards to, well, I'll make a statement first and I'll ask a question, but Philip Johnson, I'm sure you know him in the Adelaide Hills, great winemaker, great shed. He walked me through how he can get his Chardonnay with canopy management and the like to almost get those steely characters of Chablis. And I was so impressed with it. And it's unique to that, to I suppose, that region. Hence the reason why even Piccadilly, as you said earlier on, cooler, and why things like, Tapanapa is growing well there, right? And
yeah, that Tapanapa vineyard is fundamentally the old Tears vineyard from that Brian planted for Petaluma.
Yeah, and with age, they still survive, and they still have that great minerality quality to it, rather than overblown Chardonnay that we remembered 30 years ago. But on that, right, so 50 Ks down the road from the heart of Barossa to Eden Valley, as you said, you've got the style of Henschke, which is a really soft, seductive Shiraz, and you've got big Bruce and wines that are made in Tanunda and the like. It's such an amazing landscape and terrain where the same variety can give you enjoyment in its multitudes of that expression, right? Depending on what you want to do with it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So on that, just really briefly, we're making wines with Fiano and, as you said, Tariga Nacional, et cetera, et cetera. How do the Europeans go with that in terms of that's not our indigenous variety? Do they take it with a plum or what do they do?
Yeah, they roll their eyes. Australians are perceived as ratbags and larrikins. And definitely Australian winemakers have that perception for lots of reasons. So I've got friends that sort of say, "Well, you know, what do you stand for?" type of thing. Who are you guys? But it gives us great. We've got great freedom to express ourselves. Yeah, they do roll their eyes, and I think sometimes they might even be a little bit envious in the fact that they, you know, with their DOCG and all their tough regulations, they can't even, you know, use a screw cap. I've got a friend in Greece that makes a white grape called Rabola, which is, you know, really minerally and flinty and, you know, needs to be packaged in a screw cap. But he's not allowed to. Well, he does anyway, and he's not allowed to use his appellation or his whatever. But so, look, some of those laws are, you know, are tied, but they do serve a purpose in that they protect their integrity. I don't think they're ever going to change. But, you know, all power to Australians that, you know, we've only been growing grapes for a couple hundred years, and we can grow Tarriga, we can grow Nebbiolo, we can grow whatever we fancy. There's mixed messages there and mixed feedback. But hey, we just carry on, and we look for us. It's about making the best expression of the variety, and expressing the varieties true to. Itself and true to place, and if that's Kersbrook or Macclesfield or Gummaraka or Eden Valley, then so be it.
All right, John. So I know, so our time's running out. We just have a couple more questions.
Yep.
So Bruce and Sue have said we first fell in love with this type of Chardonnay in the 1980s. It was called Never's Oak. It had a much darker colour and a much heavier, oilier taste. Do you make or know of anything that is comparable?
So Nevers, I think, is the forest, the oak, where the oak has come from, I think. I think that's where Nevers is. That's a place in France, I think. So there's some really rich buttery Chardonnay still produced in the USA. And some of them are outstanding, delicious. I haven't seen any from Australia. The US, if you can grab wine online from the US, from mainly California, if you like buttery, cheesy, yeasty, brioche, now all those old style Chardonnays that we used to make in the 90s when I was at Chain of Ponds. Chain of Ponds was famous for those big wines. I get big scores from Spectator and obviously the pendulum swung away from that now, but the US is probably the only place I can think of that still makes that richer expression of Chardonnay and lots of them. So yeah, there's a few out there,
and they're good too. Like when they're good, they're really good.
Oh sure. I tried some with Nick Stock a few weeks ago out of Oregon. Especially a Chardonnay producer that makes, you know, richer styles and leaner styles and Chablis styles and Montrachet styles, if you like. And they were, my God, you know, I can't believe it's not butter, so to speak. They were just, they were outstanding.
And now Hugh's also asked, and I'm glad Hugh asked this because this is the other one I had open tonight, about the Montepulciano. How does it compare for you to Old World Montepulciano?
Yeah, good question. So Old World Montepulciano and Montepulciano from Italy in particular is made in a plethora of styles. So you can buy it at your local cantina in a 50-litre demijohn, or you can have it in a fine dining steak restaurant as a reserve style. For us, we wanted to express this particular vineyard. So this vineyard is in Kersbrook in the LA Hills, the same vineyards where the Nebbiolo comes from. This block is on the top of a hill with about 200 mils of topsoil, so it's a really, really bony site, which naturally devigors the vines and creates multiple chain of grape concentration and tiny, tiny production. We're talking about one ton to the acre. Quite often it's 700 kilos to the acre. It's minuscule. So we irrigate it, as much as we can to maintain canopy and health. But because there's no topsoil, it just, as I say, naturally devigors vines. But what we're getting is a great expression of Montepulciano with sour cherries and some mockers, bright fruits as a young wine. This definitely needs decanting and double decanting. It's made in a reserve style. So how does it compare to the old world? I mean, it's still got that beautiful Australian fruit edge, but it's also got some savouriness and some sour cherries, which I think is sort of like a quintessential hallmark of Montepulciano.
I know. I think Charlie's asked the question of the night. Are there any older Nebbiolos available?
Charlie, get on the mailing list, mate, and flip me an email. You'll find something.
So that's a yes. Probably better once lockdown's over to come and visit, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a tiny hatful of 11. And I personally think the 11's probably a little bit more sort of savoury, a little bit more old world. And expresses a vintage. 11 was a colder, wetter year. I think it's a few boxes of 11 left.
All right. That sounds great. Hey, John, I think we'll let you go because I know your event's about to start, so we don't want to make you late.
Yeah, no worries.
That's been amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge.
My pleasure.
Sharing your wine too. The whole range is very good. I was very happy to do the event. And most people here bought the Nebbiolo, but a few people bought a bit more than that. And, yeah, hopefully everyone sort of tries some more of the wines after their chat and is excited to try some of the other stuff that they might not have jumped on yet.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for tuning in, guys, and thanks for your support. It's getting a bit loud here, so I'm trying to stick these bloody earplugs in my ears. Hey, have a good night, and hopefully this shutdown is very temporary. Take care of yourselves.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Thank you, Bruce.